Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I tell you what, the plants and, well, all of us, the humans too, are dealing with the drought. And I know some people are negatively affected and some insects are negatively affected as well. We'll talk about that with Phil today. He comes by every month to talk with us about the fascinating world of insects around us. He directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Phil, always great.
Nice to be here.
That drought has had a great effect in one area, I think, because I haven't had a mosquito bite in forever.
You know, this is what you'd expect because there's just no pooling water anywhere. And the problem that we've, I think, talked about before on the show, when we get this pleasant a year, I was out at a baseball game a week ago, and you know it was in an area that's usually pretty heavily infested, and we didn't see a mosquito. And so people forget. So when we get back to normal mosquitoes, people are not going to be happy. In fact, my neighbor made the comment. He said, you know, if this climate was like this all the time with no mosquitoes, he said, then we'd have a whole heck of a lot of people moving to Wisconsin. It will be interesting to see. But in the north, a little different because it's been wet enough, you know, that they've got the right conditions. But it has been extremely low populations, although I will tell you the first West Nile positive crow came out of Dane County within last week. So we still have
– still there.
But that's a container breeding mosquito, so it isn't as dependent on natural range as it is for people not, you know, doing their flower pots or bird baths and cleaning them out. So.
Yeah, and when you, and your bird baths, so what is it, every 3 days you should probably clean it out?
You're really okay, honestly, out to about 10 to 12 days. That's what it takes to go through a cycle.
Oh, okay.
So 3 to 5 days is more than enough.
We have Bill in Lancaster online with a question for you, so let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I was wondering if this dry weather got the paper wasps all fired up. I hardly ever get stung. I usually leave their nests alone just because I know they're a beneficial insect. But last week I got stung climbing a gate that they happen to have nests in. And then yesterday my 3-year-old and 6-year-old were in a barn playing and they both got stung. That nest was 12 feet in the air. And then just this morning I got stung again walking through a barn. I'm wondering if this dry weather's got them crotchety.
Well, the two things I've been getting calls on, one is that because water is such short supply, if you've got any place that's got water, the wasps are congregating around. But typically, if it's not a nest nearby, they're really pretty docile. The other thing that we have been seeing in the southern part of the state is there is a new to Wisconsin, a European paper wasp that has been establishing, and it makes those small open-celled nests. But what's tricky about this versus our native is it often makes them in hidden places, so you've got no idea the nest is there. And so you can be on top of a nest and pounding or bumping into something and get stung. I have been zapped the same way, cleaning out my gutters and putting my hand up there and all of a sudden get zapped. And I found they had a nest behind the aluminum flashing and that kind of thing. So that would be a couple things. And I will be honest, I'm a little bit nervous because of the climate. Historically, the ground nesting yellow jackets that tend to go after our food in the late summer like it hot and dry. And so, you know, we have not had a problem with those for the last 3 or 4 years in the state. And I'm just wondering if the conditions are right. So those three things come into play. But I am a little surprised. 12 feet with an undisturbed nest, usually you shouldn't have a problem. So.
Yeah, I asked them if they were throwing rocks at them or something, and they claim they didn't. So I guess I'm going on the faith of my 3-year-old and 6-year-old being honest.
Beekeepers will tell you that honeybees kind of mood changes with the weather. So I guess it wouldn't totally surprise me if wasps tend to get a little bit edgy, too, when things get stressful.
There you go, Bill.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Marlene in Laval, hi to you.
Hi, and happy rain. It's raining here like crazy.
Oh, good.
I went out the other day in my yard, and my hosta was loaded with a red bug. I think it's box elders. They must have been mating or something. They were almost looked like a flower with such a big ball of them. Are they going to ruin my hostas, and are they box elders, and how can I get rid of them?
Yeah, I think a good chance clustered like that, behaving like that, should not feed on the hostas at all. They're just hanging out.
Oh.
And I guess, you know, again, I'll go back to just my experiences. It's kind of fun for me because I was around in 88, and so I'm seeing some similar patterns with these drought-induced problems. But I'm expecting it to be one heck of a bad box elder bug year. Now, because they do well when it's very dry. Now, if all of a sudden it starts raining every other day from now until the fall, it probably won't come to pass. But all the conditions are kicking up. But you see this at times of lots of even immature stages clustered together. You wonder, why aren't they up in the trees doing what they're supposed to be doing? But I really don't worry about them on any kind of ornamental plants or vegetables.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. It's not an insect, but Queen Anne's lace. I mean, I am seeing Queen Anne's lace every roadside. We were golfing last night at Middleton Golf Club, and Queen Anne's lace everywhere along the edges of the woods.
Well, I'm even seeing it in people's yards because, you know, we haven't mowed for a month, and it's obviously given that plant a chance to get up and even flower in some people's yards. So, yeah, it is interesting to watch. And, you know, it's from a family of plants that honestly is very beneficial to many of the beneficial insects. A lot of the little parasitic wasps use plants in the umbelliferae as a nectar source.
Okay. All right. Deb and Dousman, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
And love NPR and WPR. Love them. Anyway, my question is, I've been really bothered by Japanese beetles. Like last year, it was terrible. I was cutting huge blooms up and bagging because they were so full of Japanese beetles. And I slightly treated in the fall, and now they're back, like in bigger numbers than they were last year. Am I better off just to get someone in to treat them, or should I keep trying myself?
Well, the thing that I always try people to sort through is, I guess for most of us, the Japanese beetles that plague our plants are coming in from down the road. So it doesn't matter what you do to your turf. And the only way I justify treating turf is if there's enough grubs to cause the damage. And that is not that common, maybe in golf courses and other places. But most of us don't have enough numbers to justify treating the lawn to save the lawn. And so, you know, then the battle just comes. You've got 2 months of adults coming in, and you can fight that fight as best you can, but realize that it really doesn't make a difference from 1 year to the next because you're not stopping the breeding.
So what do I have to do?
Well, you know, you figure they start to show up the first week of July or the last week of June, depending on where you're located.
Right.
And so, you know, you can try various foliar products that last for 4 or 5 days, realizing that's going to become a high maintenance. For some plants, you're allowed to use systemics, which you pour on the roots. That's usually done more with woody, you know, like birches and linden trees and the like. And one treatment will get you through the season for that. But as far as something that's going to solve all the problems at once, it just, unfortunately, doesn't happen.
No.
So it's just my ongoing battle then.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yikes, I hate those things. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, that's fine, Deb. Thank you for calling. And I wanted to add to that, Tom and Wanakee emailed in to say the Japanese beetle started showing up on his area in Wanakee the first week of July. Initially, there were a couple hundred dead on his driveway each day that I would sweep up. For the past 7 to 10 days, I've noticed there are almost no dead ones. Has the extreme hot and dry weather had an effect on the beetles?
No. In fact, my first question at that is whether he did or if there's a tree on the property line that his neighbor treated, because that's the classic reaction you see from a systemic treated tree. You know, in my neighborhood where we've had them for about 15 years, they're not near. And we've talked about this before, that the numbers are, 85-90% down from what they were 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I live within a block of a golf course, so, you know, that's about as bad a scenario you can get. And that seems to be the natural evolution of their populations. Now, you know, we were up for the farm technology days up in Outagamie County, and, you know, Appleton and Green Bay are areas that it's just starting to fester. And so, you know, people were just experiencing how bad that can get. But one of the things we were hedging on, Chris Williamson in our department, who does a lot of research with Japanese beetle, we're wondering in this part of the state if we would see a big emergence after a rain, as if they were going to wait for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a pretty good rainfall a week ago. I have not seen any uptick in the population, so that really is quite encouraging. The other side of it, too, is I'm guessing that there's going to be less suitable habitat for them because these lawns that went droughty are terrible places for them to lay their eggs. They won't do it to begin with, and if they did, they'd die before they got anywhere. So that would suggest that Japanese beetle numbers in general should be less next year. That being said, if I was up in Green Bay, it's still going to be bad. I mean, as I said, that first 5 or 6 years of establishment, it is the bug from hell.
We have other callers online. By the way, you can join in if you have a question or comment. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Also, post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post photos there and questions. And as a matter of fact, we have some photos. We could just go ahead and try and identify here, Phil. It's about 5 inches. The first on the left side, about 5 inches long, including the tail.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an impressive insect.
Sure. So the critter is from the ichneumonid wasp family, which are parasitic wasps. They're non-stinging wasps. This one is from the genus Megarissa, and that very long tail is really an egg-laying device. And these things go after horntails, which are a grub that you find in dead and dying maple trees and others. And they literally saw this into the log and lay their egg, and that egg will hatch and go after the horntail grubs and kill them. So when you see this thing, you know, with a 3-inch long stinger, people get very concerned about it, but it's harmless to people. And again, it's interesting. It is that host specific that it basically is a parasite of one other kind of insect, and that's it. So a very interesting and unique creature, and that's why it was so easy for me to identify it.
And then Gina says, I was doing some landscaping and digging up sod around my home, and I came across this creepy looking insect. I'm not sure it's an insect.
Looks
like a wax version of a bee, she says.
It definitely is a pupil case of something, but the picture is a little bit fuzzy. And one of the problems I have when people send me pictures is size reference. You know, I honestly was leaning towards it may even be a cicada, a pupil case. It can't be a cicada pupil case. It's got to be, could be a bee, but it could also be a weevil. I mean, I just can't get enough. You know, we can see the developing legs.
It'd be nice to have a dime or something.
Right. But also, if it was in focus, I could get a little bit better picture of the head, and that would help me out a bit. So definitely the transition stage of an insect, and as I said, beetle probably would be my first direction to go. So
okay. And then squash bugs. David Eagleton says they're everywhere. Zucchini, squash, pumpkins, cucumbers, watermelon, even the green beans. What can we do to disrupt their life cycle in a chemical-free way? What can we do next year to be prepared for them?
Okay, well, chemical-free, other than hand-picking, I just don't know how you're going to fight the fight. Although one of the things that really works quite well for the immature squash bugs are soaps. And so insecticidal soap, I think, is a more comfortable thing for many people to use. I'll tell you also that for the first time I remember in my career, I have seen a small version that's called the horn squash bug, especially in the central part of the state. It behaves very similar, goes through two generations. But if we talk about squash bugs' life cycles, they overwinter as adults, and they start the first wave right away in the spring. And so killing a squash bug in the end of May and beginning of June has big repercussions for the positive for the rest of the year. You don't wait till you get to this part of the year when you pretty much have lost it. Now, as a squash bug trap, people have had some success with taking boards, old shingles, and placing them on the garden soil in the fall of the year so the squash bug adults crawl underneath it for a sheltered site. And then you pick that up in the spring and whatnot before they wake up and kill them. Yeah. If you don't have that kind of opportunity, they're going to crawl off in the woods somewhere and spend the winter. So as I said, people have had some success in reducing adult numbers by providing them an overwintering site and then destroying the ones they find. And as I said, it's something as simple as putting a small board or something on the ground. And I like shingles because they're easy to move around.
Yeah.
And they'll crawl underneath it. And then you just got to remember in the spring before it gets very warm because they wake up pretty early.
Yeah. Get rid of them. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for all the great questions and the phone calls and the photos. Now we've got got a couple more photos that I'd like to have you take a look at, Phil. Really cool insect on the right.
Yeah, it is a critter that is a leaf-footed bug, and I can tell that from the flaring of the hind leg section there.
Really,
this is
good
an
picture.
Immature stage called the nymph. And what I'm real curious about here, I would like to know a little bit more if they're seeing these, because we got a very interesting specimen last week of something that's called a citron bug, which is a type of leaf-footed bug.
And it's a state record. It's an insect that normally is found in the southeast. It was found on a squash. It has the same banding in the antennae, and I'm just very suspicious. And what's interesting, you know, when you find an insect like that, you know, we report at the Department of Ag, and, you know, we wouldn't expect it to take off. It's a pest of citrus down in Florida. Well, we don't have too much citrus here, so that's not going to be a problem. But it will feed on squash. But when you find one adult, you wonder, did it just hitchhike? There's no evidence of reproduction. That's why I'm very interested in this particular specimen, because this would be an immature stage, which means somebody laid an egg and we're starting to get breeding. And so, as I said, that really would kind of solidify that record. And I'm suspicious.
Marilyn should give you a call or let you know somehow, or email you.
And what I have to dig a little bit more in here is that there is about five or six other species in that genus. And so this could be one of the native ones. I can't decipher because I don't have the keys in front of me right now. So as I said, but that is a really nice picture. It's a neat looking bug. And
I really don't
expect a lot of problems from it, I guess, is one of the things. It's related to squash bugs. So
here's another one from Becky. Bug about the size of an ant.
Right. But this critter, because of the comment about it biting, it hurt like the dickens.
Yeah.
The animal is officially called an aphid lion, which is the immature stage of a green lacewing. And they eat aphids, as the name implies. They have these huge sickle-shaped jaws and seem to have a little bit of a disposition problem, because I do hear about people getting bit by them. In fact, some people even have a pretty substantial reaction to it. But it's not its nature. As I said, typically it's an aphid feeder, long and skinny little guy. And as I said, you get them under the microscope and they have an impressive set of sickle-shaped jaws.
And then finally, before we go back to the phones, from Joanne, it's got a photo here. What's going on there? It looks like a nest of some sort.
Okay, so it's kind of the classic paper wasp nest on the top, rather small, but you have this long tubular extension. That's rather common in the initial stages of the development of the nest. And over time, the wasp will chew that tube away and then continue to expand on the size, and it will get that more traditional oval type of shape as it goes on. So
now it's kind of like a lollipop.
Yes. And as I said, if you've never seen one before, it gets your attention like it's something really odd. And as I said, the odd thing, by the end of summer, it won't look like that anymore. But that tube-like extension is rather commonly used. I really don't know behaviorally what advantage it is. I'm sure there's an advantage, but I'm not sure
what it is. And I would highly recommend folks go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and take a look at it. You don't have to be a member of Facebook, by the way, to go to the page. So don't let that worry you. You have to be a member in order to add things, but not to look. So please go ahead and go. It's to The Larry Mueller Show. Liz in Slinger, we are turning to you next. Thank you for waiting, Liz. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the great information. And I'll leave my questions, but then I'll get off the phone. But it seems like we've seen such an abundance of different kinds of ants. And we could just be sitting in the yard and you look at the grass and you can see the whole grass moving all around, and we see ants going up and down all the trees and walking on the sidewalks. I've seen, like, looks like an ant war. And I was just wondering, is this all because of the drought too? And thank you.
Yeah. You know, in general, when we have mild winters, I often observe that the ant colonies are stronger to start the spring. But there really has been nothing. There's not a year that goes by that I don't see a ton of ants coming in. So I have not seen anything that I would consider dramatic of increasing or decreasing the numbers of ants. And, you know, we continue to see more non-native ants doing more things. You know, the pavement ants have become more widespread. There's one called an odorous house ant, which is another European species that seems to be becoming more widespread. And, you know, the frustration with dealing with these non-native ants is many of them have multiple queens, which make them far more difficult to control than many of our native ants that have a single queen that, if they're causing problems and you can take care of the queen, the colony is taken care of. So, as I said, that part is ants are not as easy to work with as they were when I first started, but it's more because of these exotic ants continue to spread in the state.
Betty in Rhinelander, hi. Thank you very much for calling. Yeah.
I have an infestation of fruit flies. We have gone and gotten an eradicator, and I'm in the process of cleaning everything, even though the packaging said no residue left. They were in the kitchen, of course, and so I'm just going through everything. But now I'm into my cabin, and I've got them out there. And should I?
Okay. Well, here's what I tell people about fruit flies. It's all about finding where they breed and getting that cleaned up. And I don't usually consider spraying as a good method because you're not getting at the heart of the problem. And what fruit flies need to do their thing is a source of organic matter that's in some form of decay or being overly ripe. They need some form of moisture because if this was dry, they wouldn't be able to breed on it. And why this is that the maggot stage feeds on the yeast that we associate with the ripening and decaying. And so, you know, you can talk about squashes and pumpkins that are going out. You can talk about, you know, the bananas that are on the table will attract them because they smell, but the bananas are not ripe enough to be the source of the fruit flies. And so we start looking at cans that might have syrup in them. Mm-hmm. I've said on the show back when my kids were small and the once a year they got Kool-Aid, I remember very clearly about 5 days later we started seeing fruit flies, I swear, in the basement. And what the kids had done is they put their little paper cups half full of Kool-Aid and they just left them. And, of course, that all dried out. But that is sugar-based. There was moisture. The yeast started associated with it. They were breeding in the Kool-Aid, basically, the dried Kool-Aid. And that gives you the kind of idea. So old pop cans.
And you've never let them forget it, have you?
Well, my wife says that was a sign why the kids should never get Kool-Aid. So, and my kids did not get much Kool-Aid in their youth. But so, as again, it's really a detective of what kind of source would you have. And once that's cleaned up, you've shut the door. Whereas what you're doing with spraying is you're just killing the adults that are in front of you right now, and tomorrow more emerge. And so, as I said, it's really more about hunting this down. And so, you know, things caking on the bottom of garbage cans. We've even seen them breed in the slime that's associated with the pans that you see in refrigerators that they use for draining the water off, so the evaporation pans.
Yeah.
If that gets kind of slimy and goopy, I've even seen them breed in there. An old rag that you use to clean up some orange juice. If you didn't rinse that rag out, you threw it back in a corner, they'll breed on that gump. So, as I said, it gets frustrating. But you really got to hunt it down if you really want to stop it.
It is frustrating because I have taken everything out of the refrigerator, turned it off, gone over it with ammonia.
But see, it doesn't have to be the refrigerator. Those kind of things suggest to me it's something in the basement or something back, you know, out of the ordinary places. But again, you go back to it's got to be something that has some moisture. In fact, we call them vinegar flies. Fruit flies are what attack apples out in the field, to an entomologist. Mm-hmm. And vinegar fly, to me, suggests the kind of overripe, fruity smelling you associate with something that is, again, in some form of decay. So even people that you know, doing their own composting have to be careful because that is a great source of things, you know, apple peels and whatnot, as they start to break down, is exactly what the fruit flies are looking for.
I've even done the basement drain by putting ammonia down there, thinking if there's anything.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing I suggest to folks in this case is, because there's other little gnats that you get in the house, is if it just isn't solving the problem, by all means, you can send me an insect and we can be sure. Because if it's a drain fly or a fungus gnat, which are the size of fruit flies, they would present, the solution would be very different. The breeding source would be very different. So as I said, if things aren't adding up, I think the next step is get me some specimens, and then we can see what we can do.
Thank you. I hope I don't have to do that.
All right.
I'll keep being a detective.
All right. Keep at it, Betty. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Greg in Eau Claire next. Greg, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question for you about cockroaches. About 5-6 weeks ago, when my wife and I came home from a day, we noticed a German cockroach on our sink. And to be honest with you, coming from Wisconsin, I guess I've never seen one before and kind of freaked out about it. I'm trying to figure out, you know, are these guys just really good hitchhikers, and how did it get in my house? I squashed the little guy, took a picture of him, squashed him, and going online, it's pretty clear to me that it is a German cockroach.
Yeah, it's got those two black lines behind the head.
Yep, it was probably about a half inch long or so I'm guessing it was an adult, something like that. Basically, you know, made sure everything was cleaned real well. When we did look around in the pantries, we noticed, I'm assuming it was some droppings from it because it kind of looked like little coffee grounds.
Yep.
It didn't look like a lot. So it's been about 5.5-6 weeks since then, and what I've done is I put a lot of bait or traps out just to see if I have any more or anything, and I haven't seen any sign of anything throughout the house or caught anything in any of the traps.
Okay, so these are the sticky glue board type traps?
Yeah, you know, I bought some of those from a local hardware store, some of those, and then I also did put out some, I've heard you can take duct tape and smear a little peanut butter in the middle of that, and that'll work sometimes, too. So I've had these all throughout the house, anywhere there's near water sources, and basically just all around the house to see if I found anything. And like I said, it's been about 5.5-6 weeks, and I haven't had anything on a trap. So I'm just kind of curious, A, did I potentially have a hitchhiker? One thing is that my wife and I, we went to Arizona back in March, and my in-laws were actually there, and they took a suitcase of clothes for us, and they were there in a rental home for about a month. So I'm wondering, is this maybe just a little bugger that kind of hitchhiked his way back from Arizona with us? Or, you know, is it something that we could get around here? I mean,
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, I'm impressed. You did exactly what I would normally recommend, is try to get an idea if you really have a problem before you, you know, go to any kind of sprays. And it's very encouraging. You have not seen anything. You know, it's hard to say. They could have come up from a pizza delivery. You don't want to think about that, but you have the chance of coming from the grocery store or other food, because the only place you find it in Wisconsin basically is in human habitation. And and I always tell people, if you only find one roach, I'm not convinced you got a problem. I want to see some other signs of activity. I'm a little disturbed that you saw the fecal spot so easily, you know, the dried pellets, because that usually suggests more. But if there were more critters there, one would sure think in this time frame that you would see some more activity. So, as I said, I think you probably solved it, and we'll probably really never know for sure how it got there. Although, you know, one of the things you might keep track of is, if you do find another one, what were you doing in the recent past to see if you can expect it? You can go to restaurants that have cockroaches, but the chance of them coming home with you is kind of zero as far as I'm concerned, so you wouldn't think that would be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and the thing was, is we didn't see a lot of fecal matter. It was just kind of on the bottom layer of the pantries, and I'm assuming it was it, and it didn't seem like a lot to me, but I'm guessing that's what it was, so I'm wondering if he had, you know, been hiding out for a month or two in that area. And
Could have been,
yeah.
Definitely could have been. Thank you very much for calling, Greg. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the Facebook page because we have some more photos. And the one photo is on the left here. Listener Dan shared this photo. We're lucky to see one of these each year. They like to rest on the green trim of the garage. And it's a beautiful moth.
Yes, that's the Luna moth, which
it's a kind of a lightish green color.
It is one of the wild silkworms, and what makes Luna distinct is these incredibly long tails. And, you know, the moth itself can have a wingspan upwards of about 5 inches. Very short-lived as adults. They have no functional feeding mouth parts, and this is really the same for most of those species in that group. They need to find a mate and lay eggs in a day or two. And they honestly could live longer than that, but between the birds and the bats, this is such a great prey. And if you've ever been lucky enough to see one fly, they're not very fast. And so, again, they're an easy target for the bats in particular, because that's when they're flying. You know, you would think they should be more common because we have plenty of trees, birch trees, hickories and whatnot that their caterpillars feed on. But their success rate at raising young is pretty low. And so neat creature, you know, and a great pitcher. I used to tell people I would have sold you my sister or my bike for one of those when I was a kid.
Well, here's another one. It's a caterpillar, a very hairy caterpillar, I would say. Would you say it's kind of a yellow green? Mostly yellow.
You know, I'm pretty comfortable that this is a yellow woolly bear, which is a type of tiger moth. But to be honest, what I can't see for sure, there is also some dagger moth caterpillars that are very similar. And dagger moths have these little black hairs. And in the picture is just a little bit fuzzy. But because it was feeding on a more of a low-growing herb, that's something that you'd expect from the woolly bears. You know, the band of woolly bear is the one we always think about as being the indicator of the winter. But there's a number of species in that tiger moth group.
Some of them are really pretty neat. They're all kind of striped, and that's where the name comes from. But some of them are kind of a drab gray or brown. And yellow woolly bears, I've seen feed on onions. I've seen it feed on coneflowers. Is it a wide variety of things, but never enough to get in any trouble. So it's just kind of a fun insect to watch. And it characteristic of the family is that hairiness.
It's very hairy. Judy in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and Phil. I've got to tell you, my husband and I had a National Geographic special in our own backyard yesterday. I went out to my raised bed gardens. They're made out of, you know, stones put together. And, of course, there's little places where these, like, ground bees like to go in and try to make a nest and everything. And then I looked down and I saw this pile of dead cicadas. A whole pile. There must have been like about 20 of them. And I says, what in the world? And then I saw those bees hovering around them, and there was one giant bee. It probably was a queen bee that came out of one of the holes and dragged this fresh cicada in, trying to get it into the hole between the rock. I said, that thing is never going to fit. And finally, she gave up, and it dropped. But these other bees were hovering around. It looks like they, I don't know what they do with them, but some of them were getting dried up. And then I saw a fight between an ant and a cicada, or a bee with a cicada trying to pull them apart. And the bee would try to chase the ant away, and he'd come back. And I wanted to go in and get my camera, but it was just too fascinating, and I thought if I left, I would never see it again.
Okay, so
but
it is not
is
a bee.
What is the purpose of, of them?
Okay, so it's not a bee. It is typically called a cicada killer. And as the name implies, the females will dig a burrow. And it's a little unusual to see the pile that you saw, but you explained it, is that typically what they should do is find a bare piece of soil. The female digs a burrow. She goes and puts this paralyzed cicada in there. In fact, if she puts two of them in there, she'll lay an egg that turns into a female. If she puts one of them in there, she lays an egg that becomes a male. And then what you saw were males who are very territorial. So they keep going back and forth trying to win the favors of this female. And I think what's happened is, you know, insects being insects, she keeps on going to get a cicada. She tries to bury it. It doesn't work. And rather than moving on, she goes and gets another cicada. So she's been back doing this a number of times, because normally you don't see them clustered on the top. Normally you might see three or four holes in your garden where they're provisioning these burrows. And now what's kind of fun for me is, you know, when I grew up in Madison and was a graduate student here, we'd have to go to Indianapolis to see this. This is a phenomenon that this was not considered an insect that was doing well in Wisconsin. But in the last 10 years in particular, they've become quite common. In fact, to be honest, we had done a shoot with Shelley Ryan with Wisconsin Gardener last year on the cicada killers. And I guess it's airing this Thursday, at least down in Channel 21 down here in Madison. And just to get people informed, because it's big, scary looking, but they're really pretty docile creatures. I mean, I don't really get nervous about
it. We could get really close. We didn't bother them at all. I mean, they didn't go after us or anything. They were too busy working.
Right.
And but what I'm wondering is, what is the purpose of these? You say they're not bees. I mean, what is their purpose other than killing cicadas?
Well, that's how they raise their young. I mean, they're basically, you could call them parasites or predators. I mean, it's kind of an interesting dynamic here, because the most wasps will catch various prey, caterpillars, spiders, in this case cicadas, lay their eggs, and then their larvae develop on that as the food source. What bees do is they collect pollen for the same source. So bees don't eat other insects, wasps do. And this one basically banks its whole life on cicadas. If there's no cicadas, they're out of business. But we've always had cicadas, and it's interesting. So I heard the first cicada in my backyard about the last week of June, and lo and behold, by the first couple of days of July, people were calling me about cicada killers. And since it's a relatively new problem, and again, it's the biggest, meanest-looking wasp you can have in the state, so that gets people's attention. Best way to describe it, if you've not seen it, it looks like a giant yellow jacket. It's got the black and yellow stripes on the abdomen. in more of a reddish thorax, and very visible when they're flying. As I said, it looks almost like the size of a good-sized dragonfly. Not quite as width of it.
She had like brown wings.
Yes.
And they were, she was scary looking.
You know, and you probably have a photo of those up on your page,
yes.
Don't you,
and in fact,
Phil?
To be honest, we even put together an information sheet on cicada killers that we have on site, and we have at some of the horticulture sites, because, again, it's become a common enough problem that people at least have to understand it. And, you know, one of the things you can do when they're attacking a flower garden, honestly, in the long run, if there's no bare soil, there's no critters. And so putting mulch, that's what was done on campus here in some places that we had problems with, is putting about 3 inches of bark mulch, and they move on somewhere else. They're looking for bare soil.
The funny part of it was, though, they didn't go down through the soil. They were trying to get through the bricks that were, that were made into the raised bed garden and into the little hole.
Yeah. Well, again, it's looking for a place it can dig a cavity. And the poor decision here is there wasn't enough diameter there for it to be able to be successful in dragging a cicada down. Mm-hmm.
Judy, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lines are all filled right now, but we'll have some open lines in a minute. Go to my Facebook page if you got a photo or a question. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. And Phil, we have a listener, Christine in Stoddard, who found this critter on the window screen in the morning. I'm trying to describe what it might look like. It looks like a helmet with wings.
Yeah, well, I always tell people it's got kind of a froggy eyes.
Yeah, it does.
It has very long wings compared to the size of the body. The wings are twice as long.
Yeah.
They're as big around as your thumb and kind of a froggy green color. And so this is the dog day cicada. So this is the thing that hums up in the trees on a nice warm day, and this is also the prey of the cicada killers. And
so it was perfect timing to get that photo.
Yes.
All right. Janet in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. It's so funny how much we love talking about our bugs.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about moths and butterflies for a second. Right now I'm raising 4 Cecropia moth caterpillars, and they're just little guys right now. And my question regarding them is, I know that they like to eat the leaves of fruit trees, and I have a large pear tree. It's maybe 20 feet tall in my yard. And right now I'm just cutting little snippets and putting them in my container to feed the caterpillars. But do I need to worry at all about once they hatch, I guess, emerge from the cocoons next spring, do I have to worry about them laying eggs and having hundreds of caterpillars defoliating my tree? And then my second question.
With that one, I have never seen it. The only time I've ever seen it is a very small young maple tree that had a couple big caterpillars. And, you know, then it was a transplant. But a big tree like that, you'll never know they're there.
Oh, good. Okay. And then the second question was regarding monarchs and swallowtails. It seemed like we saw a lot of them at our early spring, but now I haven't seen any for quite some time, and I'm wondering if they're affected by the drought at all.
I think it's pretty stressful. It comes to the point that, nutritionally speaking, when plants are under stress, the diet is not as good for insects. And one of the things we find is that lower moisture in leaves is not good. And so, you know, going back to your Cecropias, it's good to give them fresh leaves every couple of days. The leaves dry out enough over time that it's going to affect the quality of their digestion. And so I think that's what's going on, among other things out there, is that, yes, we did have quite an influx of southern butterflies in the spring coming up in the winds. And monarchs were up here quite early. But I'm not seeing a lot of, we've got some butterfly weed around the house. I have seen, even though monarchs have been through the neighborhood, I've not seen any sign of any monarch breeding. Now, you know, naturally, there's a very high mortality, so maybe they did lay eggs. But the butterflies in general, we're kind of in a lull right now. I did see a tiger swallowtail yesterday, but, you know, there was a bunch of giant swallowtails out in June. I was enjoying that. But it may just be stressful enough on the plants. It wouldn't surprise me one bit that this is going to affect our butterfly populations for the rest of the year.
Okay. Just wondering. All right. Thank you very much, guys.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. A couple years ago, actually, but this bug has been, like, on my mind. A couple years ago,
I found a beetle, and I did identify it, so that's not a question. But I found it in my garden, and it was so cool. And it ended up being called something like a six-spotted, and I don't remember the rest of the name, but it was like really, really green. It looked like an emerald ash borer,
yeah,
but it wasn't.
It's a tiger beetle.
Okay. So my question is, I'd never seen it before, and I've never seen it since. And my question is just how many of them are there out there, and are they beneficial?
Yeah, they are beneficial. They're related to ground beetles, so they're predators, and really very active in searching down their prey. So they feed on cutworms and other little critters going around there. Very good flyers, and to be honest, they're kind of a nervous insect, and so when we go out to try to capture them, it almost takes two people, because what you find is when you're walking, they fly up ahead of you, they turn around and land, so they're looking at whatever was disturbing.
Oh.
And so honestly, you have one person basically driving them, distracting them, while the other person can capture them or take photographs. And tiger beetles, I would suggest get on the internet. There's just all kinds of neat tiger beetles, all forms of metallic blues and greens. A neat critter, definitely are.
And thanks
a
lot. Yeah.
Do they have a healthy population?
Yeah, although, you know, there are different habitats. I see more tiger beetles in sandy areas than I do in heavier soils. There are, if you look, it's a very popular group with collectors. And you do find that there are some endangered species along the Snake River and whatnot. But generally speaking, if you know where to look for them, they're more common than people think.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Should mention that tomorrow at 11, our program is going to be about the Karner blue butterfly. So we're talking about endangered species this whole year. We're doing something every month with the Wisconsin DNR. And the Karner blue butterfly on our minds tomorrow. That'll be a lot of fun.
Well, when we were up at Farm Tech Days, one of the things that we had ongoing in the tent is for people had to kind of scavenge hunt and answer some questions. And so the entomological question was, what is the state insect? And to be honest, it's the honeybee.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was up to entomologists, we thought the monarch might be a good choice because of the beautiful story involved. Everybody can identify it, and it's a native insect. The argument against the honeybee is it's not native
to
North America.
Yeah.
But one of the people who stopped by the booth said, you know, what it should be is the Karner blue. And when you sit and think about it, you know, because again, it's a very unique Wisconsin story, I think you could make a strong argument that that would be a critter that you could consider.
Absolutely. We have a Facebook page here, photo of a bug. It's kind of orange and I would say gray, almost stripes kind of on it.
Yeah. I know it's a moth, and in the back of my mind, it's bumping around. Now, this was taken up in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
It is not the tiger moth itself. I'm going to have to do a little bit of digging, which, if people are interested. So when I was growing up, there was a Peterson Field Guide to the moths of Eastern North America, and it was basically the Bible. It has come under a new revision. In fact, it just came out about 4 months ago, and I got my copy from Amazon, and it is new and improved, might be a way of putting it.
Oh,
and so
great.
That would be a book. You know, it won't get every moth that you see, but it will get a majority of the more common ones, and honestly, it's my kind of go-to little field guide to kind of sort through things. So that would be something somebody would look at. And so, as I said, the other place I would go for that moth, and this is a site you've got to be careful of because it is so expansive that you can kind of get lost in it. But there's a site called Bug Guide. In Bug Guide, if you go under the moths and work to it, I want to say that this is a tanucid moth. It's spelled C-T-E-N-U-C-H-I-D. They're very brightly colored because they're foul tasting. So that's the first place. Is look under tanucid moss there and see if you can find the creature photographed.
And all our talk about cicada killers, here we go with Alan sends us a great photo.
Yes, of both the cicada being dragged and one of these large wasps. So if you have access to Larry's page and you wanted to see what we're talking about, that is just a grand picture of this phenomenon, as I said, which is for most of us a relatively recent occurrence.
Wow, it is. It's quite the picture. And just to the left of it, another topic that we had earlier, the underside of a Luna moth that Cindy French got took a picture of through their window. So she got the underside of the loom.
Yeah, the underside and the antennae. And what's interesting about wild silkworms, you can tell if they're boys or girls by the shape of their antennae. The males find the females with the use of these antennae. The female gives off a pheromone that attracts it. So the males have a much bigger, more feathery antennae on them. And the females, because they don't utilize that for finding mates, have a much smaller, skinnier antennae. So from this picture, because of the large feathery antennae, I can tell that's a male Luna moth.
Very good. And just one more before we go back to the phones from Janet from Glenville, Illinois, Glenview, Illinois. Outside a screen, quite a large-looking insect.
So it's a critter we would call a long-horned wood-boring beetle. The family is Cerambycidae, and long and skinny, and one of the characteristics is these long, skinny antennae that are usually as long to as much as twice as long as the antennae. To be honest, it reminds people of cockroaches sometimes, because cockroaches have relatively long antennae. Now, I can't tell what species it is, because it's not clear enough picture of the back of it. And it's a very big group. And really some of the more stunning beetles that we have in the Midwest come from this group. We've got ones that have got orange stripes on gray backgrounds and really quite attractive. This one is more of a dull brownish, but there's a number of those. And as I said, I'm guessing in the Midwest, one can anticipate probably about 130, 140 species of longhorns.
Wow.
Commonly associated with firewood, because we find these attacking dead and dying trees.
Hmm.
So you harvest the tree, you cut it into firewood, and these beetles emerge. But as a group, really not considered destructive. They're always in trees that are pretty much in dying anyway. So,
Kelly in Clintonville, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I've been finding daddy long legs that are just covered in those red spider mites. And I'm wondering, I've never seen this before, and I'm wondering if it's because of the weather, of it being so much... warm and everything?
Well, the first thing, they are a red mite, but they're not spider mites. I know it's kind of confusing. In fact, red spider mites are usually not red. Spider mites are a plant feeder. What this is a parasitic. Well, it's one of two things. There are parasitic mites on insects and other creatures, and that's what I think you've got going here. So you'll find them on the abdomen, and they're literally feeding on the body fluids of the harvestman. But in some cases, we find other mites that are hitchhikers. Primarily, I see this associated with insects we find with dead animals and carrion. And there are various predaceous mites that feed on fly maggots and whatnot, and they tend to get on the carrion beetles and other things and hitchhike because they know the carrion beetle is going to go to the next source of food, drop the mites off. And so, as I said, it's one of two things. Either the mites are hitchhiking, we call that a phoretic behavior, or they are parasites. In the case of the daddy long legs, I think they are the parasitic form.
Thanks, Kelly, for calling. Yeah, and Sally in Beaver Dam, your turn now. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a moth question as well. Back in May, I was digging in my garden, digging up some weeds, and I uncovered what I think is a wingless moth.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gorgeous creature. It was about the size of my thumb. It had a dark body with red bands on it. Its head was fuzzy, kind of a sable color, and it had antennae that were kind of a green-gray, shiny, six shiny legs. And then where the wings would be, there were just these little curlicues on either side, two pair.
Okay.
I looked it up on that website you suggested, the bug net.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find any
flaws.
That are native anyway.
Well, so two things going on. You did a great job of describing it. There are wingless moths like tussock moths and spring canker worms. And to be honest, most of the wingless moths are pretty drab, you know, just little fuzzy creatures with not much going on. And from what you described with the markings, I think you found a hawk moth that was emerging from the ground. And the question is, was it deformed and the wings did not develop properly, or was it so early in its emergence that the wings could still unfold? I'm going to the deformed, to be honest. But what I would suggest is go under hawk moths and kind of, when you look at the images of the body and the striping and whatnot and the fuzziness and the antennae, look to see if that matches. And as I said, by nature, I don't know of any wingless female hawk moths. But I have seen hawk moths with deformed wings that would very much fit the description of what you described.
Mm.
It didn't seem like it had been injured, But
yeah, but see, I mean, it's a developmental mutation, you know, much like a deformity, I might be saying. Okay. So it was deformed in the pupil case. This is how it emerged in lichens. You know, you'd find them in the ground and coming crawling out of the ground as they're emerging. And it's just a question, were the wings capable of expanding, or were they so deformed that that's exactly what the critter was?
And I was going to take a picture, but it was so pretty I wanted to put it back. So I showed it to my husband, put it back over in my herbs, and I've been wondering about it for months since.
Yeah, normally if the wings are going to unfold, that's a, you know, 2 or 3 hour process, but it's relatively quick, in fact. And so, as I said, I'm just suspicious, and you know, people experience this sometimes when they're raising wild silkworms and hawk moths, that when they come out, the wings are not formed properly. And that's often a sign of not enough moisture. Now, you wouldn't expect it outdoors, but and other things can cause it. But as I said, when we find people have rearing problems with some of these things, it was a sign that things just got too dry in the house and they didn't develop properly.
Hmm.
Well, I'll look it up. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Pretty appreciate your call. In 25 seconds, anything new in the lab coming across? Any interesting insect?
I'm a little surprised with the false chinch bugs and some of those other things they said, but the big one of last week was that citron bug. Because, you know, but this has been that kind of pattern this year. A lot of southern things have decided this is a good place to be.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You'll be able to join in. I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post your photos and your questions right there. And we'll be back with Phil right after this look at the news. In the heat of summer, there are a lot of insect activities going on outdoors, but that doesn't mean some aren't getting indoors as well. And sometimes it's hard to know what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Lucky to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri here for the next half hour to talk about the fascinating world of insects. He's got lots of great information to share, and I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Those lines are all filled right now, but you could also email us at talk@wpr.org. And I do hope you'll go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or a question or comment there. We have lots of great photos up today that have just come in today. And so I hope you'll go to the Facebook page. And while you're there, click like, and we'll send you regular updates. Back with Phil right after the news. Insects are really fascinating creatures, aren't they? They do a lot of good, including they pollinate key crops. Some eat other insects that can do a lot of damage. And then there are insects like the emerald ash borer that can be very difficult to contain and can really raise heck with the environment. Phil Pelletieri, director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, our guest today to talk about this fascinating world of insects. You may have questions for him. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post a photograph or ask a question right there. And Phil, we have an email with a different take on Japanese beetle traps. This from Shelley, who says, I know you say not to bother with the traps. However, I think if everybody put the traps up, we'd see a large reduction in the population. I have traps up in various locations. They catch thousands of adult beetles every day. Imagine if everyone put up traps, we would reduce the population. There would be so many traps, they wouldn't be drawn to an area because of the traps. The traps would be everywhere.
So it has worked in Colorado, but it is in the eastern part of the state where you've got these irrigated towns and nothing around it. So you've got them surrounded. And with very extensive trapping and at quite a cost, they have been able to trap them out. The problem here is your donut is as big as the state.
Yeah.
And this was tried a number of years ago, the Master Gardeners up in Wisconsin Rapids. We thought we had the infestation confined to about a 4-block area, so it was relatively recent. They trapped the devil out of the parameter, caught all kinds of beetles, and we just couldn't see a difference in the numbers. And so, as I said, it's the magnitude. If you had them confined, and of course in Colorado, the desert's too dry for being a breeding spot, but the irrigated
place where people live is what was going on. But here it's just all the fields and everything else. It just, as I said, it makes you feel good. You catch a bunch of critters, but in the long run, it really doesn't. It just shows you the success of the populations.
And Charlie in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, this is a great show. We're traveling through, and I'm a tennis coach, and I have one particular student, but I've had other students who are just terrified of insects of any kind, any size, particularly flying around.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if you know of any ways to help people through that kind of phobia and see things differently.
Oh. Well, I think in cases where it really is disturbing, you almost have to go to a psychologist and get desensitization. I mean, people do that for spiders and people do it for insects. You know, sometimes I think it's worth starting out with something that everybody can identify, butterflies. So, you know, going to right now in Madison, and I know in a number of communities we have these butterfly exhibitions where there's live butterflies flying around, and, you know, a butterfly's never hurt anybody. So that may be a place of just trying to warm up to it and the like. But, you know, it's interesting in just conversations with people. So often this is a learned behavior. It'd be interesting to ask your students if their mom or dad were particularly fearful of insects, because I think little kids react to that as somebody goes screaming because something's flying at them. It becomes quite a learned behavior. But as I said, when it really gets serious, I think it may be the time of seeing if you can get a desensitization, which is just kind of, you know, immersion, a lot of exposure, and over time you find, and eventually you start touching the insects and see they don't bite. But it does take a little bit of time to work through.
Yeah. There you go, Charlie.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Sarah in Lake Mills. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We had a very scary-looking wasp creature in our garage, and my husband has anaphylactic reactions to hornets and yellow jackets and wasps, so of course it was pretty scary for him. I have a co-worker whose son is really into bugs, and they identified it with a very fuzzy picture on my phone as an ichneumonid wasp or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been a female because she had really long tentacles off the end that they said were ovipositors.
Right.
I'm just wondering how common they are. I've never seen one of those before. Yeah. We live out in the country, so we get a lot of, you know, yellow jackets and wasps out there, and
yeah,
also wondering how dangerous.
Okay, they're absolutely harmless to people.
Oh,
they are absolutely
goodness.
Your worst nightmare if you're another insect, because they're all parasites.
Okay.
They all
okay.
use these egg-laying devices, the ovipositors, to lay their eggs into their prey, and so they literally, their grubs eat internally in other insects, but it is not a stinger. And so
okay.
nothing to worry about there. And again, we had a picture. The first one that was we talked about today that was on Larry's Facebook was the biggest ichneumonid wasp in Wisconsin, which is the one associated with wood boring beetles or wood boring horntails. And literally that thing with the ovipositor extended is upwards of 5 inches or so. And so,
she was pretty big. So.
Yeah. So definitely
go
nothing
ahead.
To worry about. And, you know, wasp is a very big group, including stinging and non-stinging forms, and I think that's where some of the confusion comes to people. And, you know, historically, these things were always egg-laying devices. It's just some
yeah.
of them have evolved them into the, quote, stingers that we associate with bees and wasps.
Okay, well, thank you very much. He'll be relieved.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, you know, here we are back at Facebook again with some great photos. Here's a tiger moth, and, you know, tiger moth, that's a great name for that insect because it's got striping kind of like a tiger, doesn't
this
it?
This is one of the more ornate species, and depending,
really
we can't
pretty.
See the hindwing, but some of them have bright oranges or yellows or reds in their hindwing, so it's a very attractive moth. As I had mentioned, the yellow woolly bear turns out not to be quite this stunning when it grows up, but a pretty easy group of moths to identify, and as I said, that is a great picture.
And Katie sent us a photo of this is like all white and sort of long.
Yeah, long, skinny.
Pencil-like.
You almost might think it's a walking stick kind of creature, but it has a very pronounced front pair of legs and a triangular face. And so this is a mantid of some sort, and it's an immature mantid because we don't see wings developing it yet. So it's what we call the nymph. And we've talked about on the show, it's interesting that mantids, none of them are native that we see in the state, but mantids never were capable of surviving here because their eggs would freeze out. But
We definitely know in the last 10 years we have breeding populations in the southern part of the state in Door County, and we equate this to the lack of significant cold. And so a very easy to identify insect, a very beneficial creature, just fun for the kids to watch. And, you know, you'll see good 4 inches by the time we get to the late summer.
Email from Carol. While listening to the show, she checked her tomatoes and found they were being eaten away by at least 6 hornworms on them. While they have interesting feet, they have eaten my plants on the top. I pulled them off. I understand that BT is a safe way to spray the plants at night. I've never seen them in my entire life. Now watching my other plants.
Okay, so there is a tobacco and tomato hornworm. The tobacco hornworm's a little bit more of a southern creature, but we do see it up here. And this is most people's experience. It's not an insect that is an annual problem, so it's kind of an odd curiosity. The worms are very green and well camouflaged, but as they grow, they're eating 2 to 3 times their body weight a day in food. And so when they start to get to be 3 inches long, you lose a half a tomato at night. But honestly, I'm not so sure unless you had a huge planting of tomatoes, it's worth treating for. I think most of the time you can hand pick them, that would be more than sufficient. And then just keep your eyes open. You know, what probably happened here is we had one moth lay a clutch of eggs, and 6 of them have survived so far from what it sounds like. But as I said, I it's not something I normally think we have to get something out. Tomatoes are a pretty easy crop to grow without using insecticides.
Yeah. Margaret and Nina, hi.
Hi. I have a question about wasps. We have, in a parking lot in front of our church, we have big light posts that are painted dark black. And there are some caps, I guess, over the bolts that hold them onto the concrete columns. And there, on one of them, there are hundreds of wasps that seem to be going in and out of the cracks. There's apparently a hollow underneath these caps. And these are little, they look like wasps. They're black and yellow striped, and they're not quite maybe an inch long. But they're just kind of swarming during the day all around this thing. And, of course, it's right next to where people are parking.
Sure.
And it's scaring people.
Okay. So
I'm trying to figure out, can I relocate them?
No.
Or can I just kill them?
What we always say, is it one of the paper wasps, and there are a number of species that nest in voids. So old gopher burrows in the ground, in the siding of people's houses, they get up in the wall voids. In this case, they're using the void that's inside the light pole. If you have to get rid of them, and that I usually define it, there's a lot of people traffic, the best way to do it is not during the day when they're out flying around. That's kind of asking for trouble.
Sure.
I usually wait till about 8 o'clock at night, and I would prefer a dust rather than a spray. When I can't see where the nest is, I like to dust the opening, and so when the critters come and go, that's what does them in. You can also use a spray just to get a quick knockdown, but usually if you pick the right evening, they're really not that active. And as I said, they're all inside the nest, and then when they come and go by the next day, you're done with it. And now, if this was in a light pole on the other end of the parking lot and nobody had to go around it, you'd say, why bother? Because they will freeze out, but we're talking maybe the 1st of November before the colony is dead. And as I said, the biggest threat isn't so much just being near it, but if somebody bumps that or whatnot, or somebody goes by with a lawnmower, and the vibrations of that is where you have the biggest risk of them being very aggressive.
Oh, okay. And what kind, when you say spray or powder?
No, dust.
What kind do you use?
Any dust that is registered, there will be a permethrin dust, there's a delta dust.
Oh, okay.
A bifenthrin dust. 7 dust is often used also commonly for this. Sometimes the problem is how you get the dust on there, because if it comes in a big salt shaker like applicator, that's not very easy. You almost have to get some kind of device to blow it in.
Okay.
And in some hardware stores, they'll sell something called a bulb duster, which has a straw-like end to it. You fill up the reservoir, you pump it, and it blows the dust out. And it's very effective at getting into small openings like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I needed to know. Thanks very much.
Yep. Thanks, Margaret. And Matt in Liberty Pole. Hi.
Hi. My boys and I were out working on some fence in our pasture a couple of weeks ago, and we started getting stung, and it took us a while to figure out what they were, but they were, this seems to be the wasp day, but they were a small wasp. I mean, a lot larger than the parasitic wasps we see on cow pies, but significantly smaller than a bald-faced hornet. And I'm just wondering, how we were provoking them in the middle of that pasture. Do they nest as a group? Or
yeah, well,
or
see, there was some kind of cavity or hole in the ground, and whether it was next to one of the fence posts, and you started rocking it. So they're using an old gopher burrow or something similar, and if it's hidden in the weeds, you know, it's not going to be very apparent. But, you know, normally if they're out foraging for food, and you'll probably see them, even some of these working the cow pies because they're picking up flies and other creatures as,
sure,
as a food source for their young. But as I said, somehow somebody got in that nest and got it disturbed, and then they get pretty agitated. And literally the point, and this is common for wasps and bees, is that they give off alarm chemicals when they're stinging that get the other members of the colony aggravated. And so, as I said, it if you were to step back and just carefully watch, you may see enough activity to point to where that site is, because again, they're constantly coming and going. It's like an airport when they're active, but sometimes it's kind of subtle if the numbers aren't real high, but it had to be something in the ground that you disturbed.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. James in Galena, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, I'm pleased to be able to have my question brought to you. I have an historic home. It has a second story. The second story has storm windows in front of the original windows. I have a wasp nest that apparently there's just enough of a crack between the storm window and the historic window inside that they've gotten in. They formed a nest. I have a can of wasp spray, and it says never spray indoors, and yet I have no idea. I tried raising the regular window and to spray them even with the spray that says never spray indoors, and the spray doesn't have enough force to get up to the part where the wasp nest is, and so I killed some of them, but not all of them, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure what to do, how to get rid of the problem.
Okay, so the first question is if the window's down, do you normally have to open that window for a reason?
Usually I just have it open for air, but I've got two windows in that room, so I've left the other window open for air circulation. I've kept that one definitely closed.
Okay, yeah, because one of the things to consider sometimes is if you can get away with it, why bother and just let them run their course? You know, these kind of problems, sometimes I get calls where people have sealed off their access to the outside, and then we got a big problem because that forces them indoors as they're looking for a way out. Now, the same thing as we were talking about these ground nests. In this case, if I can't get the aerosol spray to them, and I do like aerosol sprays for exposed nests, but then we take the step back and saying, well, they have to come and go, and there's an opening there, and that's where we could treat with the dust. But this sounds like it's on a second story, so now we got an access problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, what you're kind of weighing is if you can get away with keeping this shut and just let them be, you're at less risk than trying to get at the nest. But if I had to treat it, or if you had to seek professional help, as I said, I would like to see somebody dust the opening where they're coming and going from as the treatment, rather than to try to get access to the nest directly. Because I'm figuring if you're opening and shutting this window, that in itself may be enough of a disturbance to get them pretty agitated.
It does when I open the window, and then I'm afraid they're going to come in to the house itself because part of the lower portion of the window is open for them to come in when I've got my hand and they're trying to spray something
sure.
to kill them.
Right. So as I said, I mean, that's the thing to weigh, is if you had to try to get to take care of them, it's to get outside access and treat the a pathway that they're coming and going from. And as I said, it's just a question, is that too risky to be up on a ladder or whatnot? And again, that's kind of a personal decision.
I wondered if there was any type of item like you could put, you know, to sit on the window ledge between the storm window and the regular window that would emit some kind of a scent or odor that would discourage them from continuing to nest in between the storm window and the regular window.
Yeah, I don't know of any repellent that's ever been developed for wasps in particular. And so, you know, in some cases there are, and the problem here is kind of an equipment problem. You know, pest control people honestly have poles that they can put their applicators on, and these poles will stretch 15 feet and stuff, and so they don't often have to climb ladders. But to go through the expense of buying fancy equipment like that to treat one wasp nest seems to be, you know, kind of expensive. And as I said, so considering what you told me, I would just consider just allow them to keep doing their thing. And, you know, when we get to the fall of the year and the colony is basically starved out, it's not really freezing out, but they starve out, then you can open the window and scrape it and then see if there's any kind of modification to give, you know, the chance of them coming back is pretty small, but just to restrict access, because that's what this is about, is the queen found a way of crawling in there and starting everything this spring.
Hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling him. Appreciate your call.
Phil, we've had some questions, people calling back and saying, what was that moth guide that Phil mentioned?
So the Peterson Field Guide series, it has bird books and plant identifying books and whatnot, has the old version, which got reprinted, but was like $45, $50 if you could find a reprint, Field Guide to the Moths of Eastern North America. It still has the same title, but the new improved version, I think I picked up for about $18 or so. Mm. And as I said, it's well done. The pictures are really of a higher quality in the new field guide.
Right.
It's laid out a little bit differently. And there's less moths on each page, but more pages. And then they'll give you ideas of when they fly, where they're found, maybe what the food plants are, which sometimes also is helpful. And by no means it has all the moths, but it has the common moths. So again, if you have a child that's interested in moth collecting or the like, that would be the book to go to. Because as I said, it really will identify an awful lot of stuff that you tend to see commonly around your lights and the like.
Jenny in Tomahawk, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First, I want to say that I've seen every night about 8 o'clock, I see the sphinx moths flying around my flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting, but that's not really what I called for. I found the other day on a milkweed, which I had left for butterflies.
Yep.
And I found it was like overnight. Two of the big leaves of it completely skeletonized. And then on two other leaves were completely covered. Must have been hundreds of them there. Very small, little, I suppose they're a caterpillar, but they don't look like what I think of as a caterpillar. Larvas, I guess. They were probably less than just under an inch long, very, very brown and black all around, like they had a black flounce that surrounded them. I mean,
sure.
I couldn't see legs, but it was black all around them.
Okay, I think it's a milkweed tussock moth caterpillar. Full grown, though, they get maybe about an inch and a half. They often feed in colonies like that. And if you look at them, they're fuzzy. I mean, there's lots of hairs coming out, brown hairs, black hairs, even some white hairs coming out of them. And so that would be my guess, is that you had a moth lay a clutch of eggs, and she's getting pretty good survival, because normally you don't expect to have hundreds left at that size. But that's what it is. And it is another creature that's pretty exclusive, as the name implies, to milkweed. So it's a competitor to monarchs, but there's more than enough milkweed to go around out there. So,
mm-hmm.
And that's your description seems to fit.
Do anything besides be a competitor to monarchs?
No.
Pretty much it.
Well, I did get rid of them because.
Sure.
I couldn't imagine any butterfly that they could turn into, or moth. You know, I couldn't.
Yeah. Yep, understood.
Now, your comment on sphinx moth, you know, it's interesting, you know, without you describing, but I will tell you that 3 or 4 weeks ago, I got a number of reports of large numbers. And in fact, one case, the county agent up in Chippewa was telling me of thousands of white-lined sphinx caterpillars migrating across the highway. I mean, I wish I would have been there. It would make some great pictures. And so with that being said, and I've had this from 3 or 4 other counties, I'm expecting lots of white line sphinx moths. And what's unique about that one, the name implies it's got these white lines in the front forewing, but it is somewhat of a day flyer. And so it's not unusual to see them an hour or two before dusk hovering around. So this is one of those treats you only get about once every 8-10 years. And so those of you in the right part of the state, you may, if you've never seen a hawk moth before or sphinx moth, this may be the year to do it. Because when these things get going, sometimes you get 5 or 6 work in your garden at the same time, which is a lot of fun.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Rosie in Woodruff, do you have a quick question?
Hi, I'll make it quick. I have a spider that I'm just trying to find on your identification page, and I can't see anything like it. It's a fairly good size. The back of the body is like a big fat bean, and it's gunmetal gray with some very faint gray marks on it, a little white kind of stripe towards its head, and it's got very striped legs, gray and white cream-colored stripes.
Okay, so it's definitely an orb weaver spider. The family is Araneus, or that's a common genus, but there are multiple species, and I describe them. The banding of the legs is very significant.
Mm-hmm.
The round bean-shaped abdomen, which can be highly colored depending on the species, and what makes them tough to identify is even within a species, they're quite variable.
Mm. Okay.
You know, you have some that are orange with white dots, and you have another one that is just barely pinkish, and it's the same species. But definitely, as I said, an orb weaver spider, and it's just a question of working through and seeing something that matches.
That's exactly why. I just keep seeing all these different, you know, nothing. I figured it's a variation on something that I'm just not getting to. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Phil, thank you so much. We went through lots of questions. There's still more. Gosh, there's a great photo of a spider.
Same thing. That's another orb weaver, just a different species. And that, if anybody wants to see kind of a classic one, that would be. And then, of course, the black and yellow garden spider is in that same family.
And that's on the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Phil, we'll look forward to our next visit. Thank you again.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening. And stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.